So welcome to the sixth of the podcast, and today we're going to be talking about the USA and the mighty dollar. And really we're going to explore, you know, why is the US in a different place from a payments and regulatory point of view? And I have with me today my very good friend, Eric Grover.
Welcome. Hey, Paul. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, so Eric, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. But in particular, you know so much about what's happening in the US, what has happened in the US, and I suspect what is going to happen in the US, and perhaps we'll come to that later. But to be fair, the US is slightly different in the way that it regulates compared to just about every other country. And it can be a little bit confusing for many people, especially those outside of the US. And frankly, even for those in the US, some of the things that like the Fed do, it's not particularly clear. But, you know, I've been lucky enough to travel all around the world, and I have a drawer full of notes and bills from different countries. Some are in hundreds, some are in tens, some are in thousands of whichever currency it is. And frankly, I'm not even sure how much of these are worth and whether even some of them are valid now. I've had them for so long. However, that's just not true for the dollar. The dollar, you know, is frankly even, you know, is effectively the practical currency that runs different countries. And even though they have their own particular currency, people use the dollar because their own currency is just quite, you know, volatile, whereas the dollar is, you know, stable. And sure, people would argue that it's not that stable, but frankly, compared to many a country, it is. And in fact, one of the interesting stats that I read was that over 50% of all the US dollars are outside of the US. That's incredible. So really just the dollar itself is unique. And with the US being the single largest payments market, this is almost a very different world to other countries.
Yeah, so king the dollar, I mean, I think king dollar is the world's reserve currency. And by almost any measure, in their whole range of measures, the central bank reserves in foreign currencies, the dollar is on the order of 60%. Foreign currency denominated debt, export invoices denominated in dollars. The Fed has an index in which they look at a variety of factors: FX reserves, FX transaction volume, foreign debt issuance, foreign currency denominated debt issuance, foreign currency and international banking claims, foreign currency and international banking liabilities. And with that index, over the last 20 years, the dollar has been rated from just over 70 to 68, 67. The euro is a distant number two, low 20s. And then the yen, the pound, and the Chinese yuan, a very, very distant number five. If you think about currency as a network, the dollar enjoys ubiquitous acceptance. If you were parachuted into the Hindu Kush with a $100 bill, or in the Amazon or in the Kalahari Desert, and you encountered someone, they'll accept a $100 bill and they know what it is. Whereas if you gave them a Lebanese lira, the likelihood is that they wouldn't accept it. It is unlikely that the dollar, notwithstanding the U.S. arguably abusing it's the position of the dollar being the world's reserve currency, there's no obvious replacement. It's also the case that there are many countries where the dollar operates as legal tender. Ecuador, Costa Rica, Panama, the countries, Hong Kong uses the dollar in a currency board. And so the Hong Kong dollar is pegged to the US dollar. The dollar widely circulates in countries who have debased their national currencies, Zimbabwe, Venezuela. You're quite right that over half of US physical currency is circulating outside the US. Some of it is a store of value, some of it perhaps to conduct illicit commerce. But that reinforces the network effect. It is a so I don't see that changing anytime soon. The King dollar enjoys ubiquitous acceptance. Has utility.
And it's, you know, while to be frank, sometimes outside of the US, people, you know, can take pot shots at the dollar and, you know, saying, oh, you know, the King dollar. But the truth of the matter is, it is in a very unique place. And while, you know, frankly, nearly every other major currency is very jealous of its position. But as you say, it's not going to be, it's not going to be coming under pressure anytime soon, I don't think.
No, there's just no obvious replacement. I certainly wish the dollar were more stable, but it's stable compared to relatively stable, and relatively being the operative word or qualifier, it's relatively stable. There's a depth of use in the markets. There's no obvious, viable, credible alternative in the foreseeable future.
No, I think that's, I think that's absolutely right. But it's also interesting, as we point out, the dollar is unique, but there's also a different level of scale as well. There are some, close to 5,000 banks registered with the Fed. There is many more credit unions. In fact, there's an extraordinarily long tail, as well as, just the sheer, number of, household world names, the Citibanks, the Goldmans of the world, et cetera, that, we have a mixture in the US of sort of amazingly famous bank names, and that's a unique position in its own right, as well as very local banks that maybe only operate in one town. Yeah. And, there are some 330 million people in the US all speaking the same language. We could get into Spanish and other things, but nevertheless, essentially they're all speaking the same language. And there is some history here too. I mean, this isn't like, we might joke it's a relatively modern, country by some standards, but the truth of the matter is the first dollar coin, I think, was minted in 1764, and paper bills in 1862. The first wire in by Western Union was done in 1872. And while many of these aren't world firsts, they are world first very close to it, but they have the scale and they have maturity. So, many of our listeners here will be going, hold on a second. What about China? What about India? But, really, the US is really different in its history, its maturity, its sheer scale.
Yeah, so there's some interest. It's fascinating. So the US banking system, you quite rightly point out, it is the US banking system has been more fragmented historically than almost all markets on the planet. The U.S. still has far more banks than commercial banks than any other country on the planet. Notwithstanding the number of banks in the U.S. has been declining steadily. Back in 1921, the number of banks in the U.S. peaked at 30,812 commercial banks, which is just enormous. And of those, most were unit banks, one office. 1935, over 95% of U.S. banks operated as unit banks. Today, it's under 20%. So there's still a significant number, but most don't. There has been significant and continuing consolidation, with the exception of a couple of years during the Great Depression, and then a brief period in the mid to late 1970s through the early 1980s, when the number of commercial banks was increasing. 1984, there were 18,000 commercial banks in the US. So, huge decline, but still far more than any other country on the planet. Today, there are under 5,000. on commercial banks, on top of which they're just under 5,000 credit unions, and they continue to decline. But that's still a far greater number of banks than any place else. Now, there are a handful of countries that have comparable or greater number of banks per capita. Switzerland, as an example, has slightly more banks per capita. It is a case, and there's a mix. Most, we have the small banks that you know, are subscale by a lot of measures. And we have, you know, the, you know, globally established brands that you cite, you know, Chase, Citi, B of A, Wells. The 1994, there was a piece of legislation called the Regal-Neal Act, which introduced interstate banking. There were a handful of states before that enabled it, but this, at a national level, enabled branch banking across state borders. The fact that the U.S. banking system or banks were so fragmented, in fact, introduced a lot of risk because you had banks exposed to particular local markets as opposed to nationwide exposure. There is a there's a book, a fascinating book called Designed to Fail by Charles Karamaras and Stephen Haber, in which they make the case that if you look at, in every country, there's a political bargain between the banking industry and the government, whether it's an authoritarian government, democratic government. Among democratic developed nations, the U.S. banking system has been far and away the most crisis prone of any major, you know, developed democratic nation. And their argument, and it's pretty persuasive, the reason is that the U.S. banking system has been the most politicized. So the bargain between you know, banks has been, where in contrast, Canada has essentially had no really major catastrophic financial crises in two centuries, whereas the U.S. in the 19th century, the 20th century, has been in and out of crises. You know, most of which, if you peel through, you know, stem from some political bargain. And I suspect that that's not going to change. You cited some early introductions of payment vehicles in the U.S. You know, the wire transfer, the general purpose payment card, the first general purpose payment card, Diners Club, was introduced 1950. You know, Frank McNamara, the global bank card systems, Visa and MasterCard. You know, Visa came out of Bank AmeriCard, launched in 1958. You know, MasterCard, its cousin, launched 1960s, you know, and these gradually evolved into the predominant global retail payment systems. You can look at SWIFT, and that's not a U.S. payment network, but certainly it's disproportionately influenced by U.S. bank owners and participants. The, you know, U.S., as you rightly observe, is, you know, the biggest today payment market. It's also in the payments, so the banking regulation has been very politicized. Payments regulation historically has been relatively light. I mean, that's changing, obviously, but has been relatively light, which has been good for innovation.
Well, let's come onto that piece in a second, because I think that's one of the key things. However, before we do, we need to talk about the Fed.
Yep.
Because, you know, in every other country around the world, there is the central bank of whichever country it is, or, you know, Banque de France or what, but it's essentially the same thing. And it's pretty much always called the central bank or whatever language it's in. But in the US, we don't. We have the Fed, and the Fed is both a regulator, an operator, it's a processor. It's many, many things. And I think sometimes it's actually confusing as to what it is.
Yeah. Could you? So, the Fed, you know, created in 1913, and this was the U.S.'s third central bank. And since its creation in 1913, it has in fits and starts expanded its regulatory, the scope of its regulation, its activities, almost continuously. So today it's the central bank. It's the financial system's paramount regulator. And it's a very significant payment system operator. And those roles, I would argue, stretch the Fed. There are conflict of interests baked into those roles. So, for example, the Fed is one of two major ACH networks in the operators in the U.S., along with the clearinghouse. The Fed has Fedwire. The Fed is going to introduce in a few months FedNow, its instant real-time interbank payment network. As a payment operator, the Fed competes with the private sector, which it regulates. Mm. And to me, that's a manifest conflict of interest. The Fed is charged by statute with pricing to fully recover costs. The statute, unfortunately, doesn't impose a time frame on the Fed over which or during which it has to recover costs. The Fed has historically assumed a 10-year time horizon. For FedNow, the Fed has said that perhaps that's too short. So we have the Fed, which has unlimited resources and, like other central banks, can't become insolvent, competing with private sector operators with which it competes. The Fed is not the only, there's some other markets. If we look at Brazil, the central bank is a regulator. The central bank with PICs competes with the private sector. And I think I would argue in the Brazil case, the Brazilian central bank very obviously kneecapped a competitor before it launched PICs. The Fed hasn't done that, but the Fed does compete very aggressively on price. So the Fed is the most important, systemically important bank, and it is certainly a systemically important payment system. It does not, unlike, say, PICs in Brazil, compete as a retail payment system. It's strictly an interbank operator. And by statute, it's forbidden from serving, but its mandate is to serve banks. It can't serve businesses or consumers directly.
Yeah. But it's interesting, though, because, it does have a unique position, or, well, almost unique, if I know that's not English. But, it is very powerful, but it isn't a interventionalist regulator. And we've spoken many times whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. But, around the world, whether it's Australia or it's India or Europe, they operate very differently. They do intervene. They do come and say, hey, we have been thinking about this for a long time, and we have decided that we want to make some changes that will be good for our people, our citizens. Here's the plan. You got 18 months. Off you go. Go sort it out. Well, that really doesn't happen from the Fed. They don't intervene like that, do they?
No, they don't. And I think I would argue that's so in the U.S., the regulators, including the Fed, are charged with implementing and enforcing policies enacted by statutes, laws passed by Congress. The legislature is the primary policymaking body. And the Fed, it is not the Fed's prerogative to set payments policy. It's the Fed's mission to implement and enforce what Congress has instructed it to do. Now, I think, a purist might argue the Fed has sometimes pushed the envelope a bit. By Band-Aid, the Fed is charged with implementing, what Congress instructs it to do. So, and in the payments world, the Fed has been relatively restrained. There are instances such as the Fed's implementation of the Durbin Act, which put in place debit interchange price caps for our large banks and mandated debit network routing choice for merchants, in which I think you could argue the Fed took a very broad interpretation and how it implemented and how it's enforced that. But still, the Fed anchored everything it did in the statute. It didn't come up with policy on its own. And if you look at regulators, you look at what the Australian Central Bank has done, you know, they basically on their own prerogative decided to impose credit interchange caps. If you look at the European Commission, it's the regulator, it sets policies. And I know there's a parliament which ultimately has to approve, but the regulator, you know, has enormous authority to make policy on its own.
Yeah.
The Fed doesn't enjoy that. The OCC doesn't enjoy that. The FDIC doesn't enjoy that. You know, the CFP, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which notionally is part of the Fed, also doesn't enjoy that. Although it has been very aggressive in interpreting its mandate. There are also, in terms of U.S. The authority or scope of U.S. regulators, there is a pretty high likelihood that it was as a result of an upcoming court case. So this that the regulator's role, or a number of cases, the regulator's role will be circumscribed. So there've been a number of Supreme Court rulings holding that or affirming that regulators can't make policy, Congress makes policy, which historically the courts had given enormous deference to the regulatory agencies. And this Supreme Court seems very disinclined to do that. The CFPB is funded by the Fed. It self-appropriates from the Fed, as opposed to receiving funds from Congress. Now, Congress constitutionally is charged with giving power of the purse. There was a suit challenge against the CFPB challenging this and saying that certain actions that it had taken were void because the funding mechanism was unconstitutional. The Fifth Circuit very decisively upheld that and said that the CFPB's funding mechanism was unconstitutional. So therefore, anything that depended on its funding is at risk of being challenged. The Supreme Court it's the composition of this court. It's likely to uphold, I think, that ruling. Mm-hmm. Which again would be another check on the regulators. Light regulation or lighter regulation is generally good for payments innovation. You mentioned China and India. This is going to sound counterintuitive, but I think of China as an authoritarian state and where the government, Beijing, has control of everything. Well, China went through a period, almost a revolution in electronic payments from being, if we went back to went back to 1978, there was one bank, the People's Bank of China, and all payments virtually were in cash. In the early 2000s in China, there was one state-protected card monopoly, China UnionPay. There were a handful of sclerotic state banks, which dominated banking. Most payments were in cash. There was financial repression, meaning, consumers were paid minimum interest rates. There weren't a lot of investment alternatives. Then we had the development of Alipay coming out of Alibaba, WeChat Pay coming out of Tencent. And actually before WeChat Pay, Tencent introduced something called Qcoin, which was in fact a digital currency.
Yeah.
And these two payments behemoths, dragons, if you will, enjoyed enormous success online, and success that was enabled by regulatory forbearance, very liberal, light-handed regulation. The regulators, and there was governor of the central bank in particular, who took a very hands-off approach and let the Alipay and WeChat Pay engage in a lot of aggressive experimental innovation. in payments, deliverance of financial services, the development of super apps, and with the view of competition would force the state banks to up their game. Competition would force China UnionPay to up its game. Now, that window, as a fact, liberalization window has clearly effectively closed. But it's closed after these two systems achieved enormous scale. So, you know, we had this, you know, period where consciously light hand, very light regulation with political air cover enabled, you know, this creative ferment in payments and fintech. And, you know, not without some, you know, failures, but, you know, innovation by definition, there will be, is not risk-free. There will be failures.
No, and it's some pretty high-profile people having to take some tough times in there as well.
Yeah, yes, very much. The world's richest man at the time, or China's richest man, excuse me, Jack Ma, you know, forgot for a second, I think thought he was in the UK or US, and at a speech in 2020, you know, publicly criticized the state, the regulators, and then what was slated to be the world's largest IPO of Ant Financial, the government put the kibosh on it. And Jack Ma, he disappeared for a period. Fortunately, he didn't get the Khodorkovsky treatment, but he's, you know, he's reappeared, and now he's, you know, reduced his stake in Ant Financial, you know, and kind of stepped to the sidelines. So,
yeah, but I mean, so effectively, it would appear to me that the politics of the U.S. and whether we like the politics or don't like the politics is neither here nor there, but it is effectively, you know, has significant amount of lobbying to make sure that things are, I would say, both kept in the right way, the way that maybe the smaller banks would like rather than the larger banks. It also allows more, you know, more change through a capitalistic way. If it works, great, people.